This is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The Emory University campus shooter opened fire on at least four buildings of the nearby Federal Centers for Disease Control, says the head of the CDC. The shooter is dead, so is DeKalb County, Georgia officer wounded by the gunfire, says County Police Chief Greg Padrick.
He was committed to serving the community. At this time, we're asking for the community's prayers for his family, his friends, his loved ones, and the entire DeKalb County Police Department family.
Police in southwest Montana say they've arrested Michael Brown, accused of killing four people at a bar in Anaconda a week ago. The wildfire in mountains north of Los Angeles threatening homes is 25% contained, says the Ventura County Fire Department. President Trump says he'll meet a week from today in Alaska with Russian President Putin. The FBI announces the death of William Webster, former FBI director at 101. He headed the FBI from 1978 to 87. This is ABC News.
As Wisconsin has summer weekends being spent on the lake, this is the Civic Media Radio Network.
Up next, the Mets. Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports, baseball. The Brewers at AmFam Field tonight, opening a series against the New York Mets. Milwaukee still with the best record in baseball. NFL, the Packers host the Jets tomorrow night in their first preseason game. Kickoff at 7 p.m. College football, the Wisconsin Badgers will have their final training camp practice at UW-Platteville before moving back to Madison. It's open to the public 7 o'clock tomorrow night at the Davis Pioneer Stadium in Platteville, Wisconsin. Luke Fickell.
I do know that there's a lot of things that are going in the right direction. I worry about guys coming back out here with the right focus and stuff, and it was very competitive. It was back and forth. We're gaining this competitive maturity that we have to do if we're going to play like this, compete like this on a daily basis. I'm really excited about some of the things that went on today. There's some sloppiness, obviously, we got to correct up there at the end, but really like where we're headed.
That's Badgers head coach Luke Fickell. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
Let's go, Brewers!
You can go to the Brewers.
Wait, Todd, what?
It's Free Ticket Friday, Terry. A chance to win a four-pack of Brewers tickets several times every Friday. Great seats, by the way.
Okay, so download the free Civic Media app, find your local station, and listen for the keyword. Then text it through the app for your chance to win in this statewide contest.
Free Ticket Friday!
On your local Civic Media radio station and the app. Eagle 1490 AM.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. Well, Doug Collins, the secretary over at the Veterans Affairs area, has notified the union that, yeah, they're going to implement Trump's executive order 14251, which basically gives them the ability to set aside any collective bargaining agreement. What that means is, those workers that work at the VA, those 320,000 employees who work for the Department of Veterans Affairs, no longer have a contract. It was that quick. What took years, decades to build and to hone, now just completely out the window, gone with the stroke of a pen. And the question becomes, you know, what? Now, they're able to do this, and this is the part that gets me, because the Ninth Circuit said that they believe that the president should have deference when it comes to national security. And I agree, but I'm trying to figure out how nurses at a VA hospital in Altoona, Pennsylvania, or doctors at a VA hospital in Cleveland, or how housekeepers at a VA in Virginia, electricians, painters, food service workers, lawyers, dentists, pharmacists, I don't know, janitors, I don't know how that has anything to do with national security, other than we know what this is. This is an anti-union administration full of anti-union Republicans exerting their will. We're not going to try and make conditions better so workers voluntarily go, no, we don't, it's not something we need. No, no, we're going to take it. We're going to take it away. Now, for my union brothers and sisters, how long before you're next? And this is where it all, for me, comes back to the politics. You know, I've been hearing the steady drumbeat of, this isn't what we voted for. And I, as someone who paid attention during the campaign, as someone who actually read through Project 2025, this is exactly, if you voted for Donald Trump and any of these Republicans, this is exactly what you voted for. You voted for cuts to education, to health care, to school lunch programs, all of the horrible. If you voted for this administration or anyone who participates with it, this is what you wanted. Because you knew this was coming. And this is just one in a long list that are going to come. Because it's 320,000 right now. There's still another, 680,000 potentially able to be gutted, which I'm expecting in the coming days, the dominoes to begin to fall. And what happens then, you get job loss. You get an economy that starts to shrink a little bit. You get funding that doesn't get spent. You get less service from your government. And then you get what Republicans really want. A government that doesn't work because it can't, because they've crippled it. And then you're going to hear, well, you know, we clearly can't take care of all these veterans with the VA. We should privatize. I was a little on hold for like an hour today trying to get a message from my doctor, which I had to go through a call center and another screener, and it's a nightmare. But I got to know that they cared about my experience and that I could go to the portal if I really wanted to. And oh, by the way, they love veterans. So and they had an ad right there for me to hear how much they care about veterans and how much they want veterans to come to them, because they'll coordinate with the VA. They're already setting the table for what we know is coming. They're going to privatize the VA. They're going to profitize it. It's going to happen. The question is, are we willing to try and stop it? And at this point, can you stop it? And for me, this is why it comes back down to politics, who you vote for. If you voted for Trump, this is what you voted for. It's that simple. You don't get to go, I wanted eggs. No, no, you don't get that. Because you knew. Yeah, you knew. They told you. They laid it out in black and white, printed it out. I'm sure if you wanted, they would have given you a copy with pictures. But here we are, and now's an opportunity. So Democrats, if you're listening, this is an opportunity to reach out to the people who are not thrilled. Rural America is calling. Rural America is now up for grabs, kind of, in going, hey, this isn't what I voted for, or this isn't what I wanted to vote for. So policies that might help them seems like a good opportunity. And when we come back, Hallie Schaffner, a candidate for Senate in Arkansas, sixth generation farmer who unfortunately lost her farm, now running for Senate. We're going to have her on the program to talk about, hey, what can Democrats do? What should they do? And, well, what she's doing. We're going to take a quick break, right back with Hallie Schaffner. Stick around. This is The Rick Smith Show.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So when that nightmare, one miserable, horrible piece of nonsense bill that Trump and the Republicans rammed through, when that passed, I said, look, rural America, you're screwed. They targeted rural America in a huge way. And I said, look, opportunity for Democrats, sane Republicans, independents to maybe, you know, jump into the fishbowl, start running for stuff, because rural America, I do believe in the next several months, going to be up for grabs as the pain trickles down. Well, the tax cuts are supposed to trickle down. All that really does is going to be the pain. That's why I'm thrilled to see in Arkansas, somebody has. Hallie Schaefer is a sixth generation farmer who unfortunately recently lost the farm. The economy not great. Decided to run for U.S. Senate in Arkansas against Tom Cotton. And I got to tell you, nobody I'd like to see more out of the Senate than Tom Cotton. She had the greatest line, though. If I can't farm, I'm going to fight. And here to talk about that fight, I've asked Hallie Schaffner to come share some thoughts. Hallie, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So I love that line because it's the kind of spirit I wish Democrats would get. If we're not going to have a prosperous working class, if we're not going to get health care for families, if we're not going to be able to put food on the table, let's ball up the digits and get in there.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, I had no small amount of, I would say, indignation at having to close the farm because, and this isn't just a farmer thing. In Arkansas, a lot of us know what it's like to do everything right and to work really hard and still not make it, not because we have failed, but because the system is broken, because the economy is rigged against us in favor of corporations and politicians. And I tell this story. The first time I ever talked about the farm closing, I was invited to a town hall in Little Rock, our capital. And the 2 days prior to me being there, we had auctioned off all of our equipment. So as I stood on that stage, people were quite literally driving my equipment away. And instead of coming to that town hall as he was invited, Tom Cotton was just a few miles away hosting a reelection fundraiser at $7,000 a plate. And that is really kind of that moment that I decided that if I can't farm, I'm going to fight. Because if farmers can't make it, if, you know, mothers who are working two jobs and can't get by, if they're not making it, somebody has got to stand up and say, that is enough. This is enough.
And this is what I've been saying for a while. We need average, everyday working people, people who never wanted to get into politics. It never dawned on them before. But now we're in a moment where we need citizen farmers. We need truck drivers who are about to lose their jobs. We need people who know what it's like to work hard, play by the rules, and get shafted. We need those people in the halls of power.
Yeah, and this is not what I thought I'd be doing this year, honestly. I mean, when we rang in the new year, I thought I was going to put in my 10th season on the farm. We've been growing soybeans and rice for over 100 years now, and this is the first time a Schaffner hasn't farmed in Jackson County in over 100 years.
And the reason is this Trump's tariffs? Is this, you know, just the state of the economy? Is there a reason that we can point to?
You know, it's a lot of different things. Unfortunately, we've really started on a downhill trend back in 2018. We had our first trade war with China, and the government has kind of been throwing money at farmers for the last few years in lieu of actually having a farm bill. So the most important piece of legislation for farmers in Arkansas and everywhere else is the farm bill. I mean, that has all the provisions that we need for things like disaster relief or making sure that we're making enough money to get by. And we haven't had that legislation. It has been held up in DC for years. Tom Cotton actually voted against it twice. He was the only one in the Arkansas delegation to vote against the farm bill.
Now, here's the thing. You bring that up, and it reminds me of a Dwight Eisenhower quote. He evidently wrote a letter to his brother Edgar and said anyone who would come out against labor union, Social Security, the farm bill, unemployment, they would never be heard from in our political history. They said there are a few Texas oil millionaires, some rich people, but their numbers are negligible and they are stupid. And to hear you say that we can't get the farm bill passed, there's a lot of stupid going on, isn't there?
Yeah, you know, and this is something I'm hearing from everybody. I mean, I've been, for the last 2 months, been going around the state. I spent a lot of time on the phone, and I've been talking to people like, what's the biggest thing that's bothering you right now? And over I hear that people are struggling, and they look to DC for answers, and they can't get any because of the gridlock and the inaction. You know, one side says the sky is blue, and the other says it's purple, and no one can agree on anything. And that comes at the expense of the rest of us. And so we're down here on the ground, farmers especially, knowing that there's a piece of legislation that we need that's not getting passed. And we're thinking, we pay y'all salaries. Why can't you do your job?
Why can't you do your job? And that makes sense. And I hear that from everyone. But ultimately, doesn't it come back down to we the voters? We keep voting for, and I understand the system's already rigged. The gerrymandering that's happened across this country is out of control. The kind of voter suppression, the kind of things that are going on, I get. But at some point, red, blue, green shouldn't matter. We're all struggling.
Yeah, and that's something I'm hearing too. Is this? I would say that most Arkansans think very independently. You know, we vote for the person and not the party. And something that I want to point out to everyone that I talk to is that I'm not running to pass some party's purity test. That's really not what I'm interested in. I don't want to go to DC and join a team and play some weird game of power grab. At the end of the day, I'm going to DC to fight for the people of Arkansas. I'm going to DC to fight for workers and for farmers and for families, because they are the people that power this economy. I mean, we have to start thinking about the economy as what it is, which is from the ground up.
Yeah.
And I mean, the ground up is what I do. I'm a farmer.
No, but you know, here's the thing. I mean, we hear, you know, people all the time saying that's what they want. But when we get someone like you, our politics costs a lot of money. Billionaires have it. We keep funding these billion-dollar campaigns. Folks need resources like you do. And I hope people will go to your website and maybe look at that. But how much of that is, do you think, the problem where we are? We've given so much. We've built such a large billionaire class that we've pretty much built our own demise.
Yeah, I mean, I am one of the first people that will say that the system is broken. And that's something I hear also. And this is a bipartisan issue, people feeling like there's too much money in politics, feeling like our politicians should not be able to trade stocks while they're in office, feeling like corporations are allowed to give where, you know, individuals are not prioritized when it comes to funding a campaign. One of the things we focused on is building a very grassroots-based campaign. So we launched 3 weeks ago, and we've raised over $300,000 in 3 weeks. And our average dollar donation is $50. And most of that is coming from within this state, which tells us that Arkansans, real Arkansans, farmers and workers and families, are hungry for change. And we're not going to put up with someone like Tom Cotton, who doesn't even live here and doesn't really even talk about the state of Arkansas. We're not going to put up with him representing us anymore.
And voted twice against the farm bill, as I understand, right?
He did. He voted twice against the farm bill. He voted for the One Big Beautiful Bill, which we know will be disastrous for our state. That vote actually really baffles me, because one in every four Arkansans relies on Medicaid. And we are quite literally the hungriest state in the country. We are the most food insecure state in the nation. One in every six children in Arkansas will go to bed hungry this year. And yet he voted to gut SNAP. That just shows how truly out of touch he is, how truly he does not care about the people of Arkansas. And I have heard over and over again, the only way you get a meeting with Tom Cotton is if you have a big check in your hand.
Wow. I mean, you know, literally that bill is going to take food out of the mouths of children. And your state, like you've said, is one of the hungriest in the country. And we're giving more to our billionaire class so they can have another yacht, another home, another whatever. It seems like priorities. And I'm hoping rural America wakes up to this, because, look, I live in a fairly rural area myself here in the center of Pennsylvania, where, you know, the same struggles that you're seeing are happening here. But yet we've been put into this political divide where it's red team, blue team. I'm hoping there's some opportunity for rural voters to wake up and start looking at their best interest.
Yeah, I think I blame the national media for this. We are told that we are more divided than we are. One of the things that I love is I've been posting a lot on social media, and I get a comment a lot. People are like, are you a Republican or are you a Democrat? And here I am talking about the things that matter, you know, making sure that people can afford their groceries and their gas and their medications. I mean, these are all very bipartisan issues. And that's really what we need to do as Democrats, as a party, is be able to be laser focused on these issues that are important to families and workers in our states, and then meet people where they are.
Yeah. No. So let me ask you, as a senator, you know, clearly you're going to come in with an armload of policy ideas. You know, what's that hill that Hallie Schaffner dies on? What's that policy, that one thing you go, there's no compromise in this? Because we hear a lot, we want bipartisanship. And I got to tell you, Hallie, in my lifetime, everything that's been on a bipartisan basis has been a nightmare for working people. So I'm curious where your thought process is.
You know, I think that at the end, you know, coming from the perspective of a farmer and a small business owner and somebody who is used to working outside in the sun and the elements, my priorities are first workers, making sure that workers can maintain their rights, can have good wages and good benefits and a safe working environment. My second is that small businesses can succeed by not being overburdened by tax policies or red tape. That I believe we should start opening up new markets for industries in Arkansas that provide real jobs that we need to take care of our healthcare costs, because truly they are too high. And then as a farmer, I think we need to diversify our agricultural economy and start growing food in Arkansas as the hungriest state in the country. If we simply grew food in our own backyards and we serve that to our children, we would have food in abundance, not in a deficit.
No, that's one of the things my friend J.D. Scholten, who's running for Senate in Iowa, says all the time. Iowa should be growing all of its food and the rest to feed the nation, and they're not. They're not. And it's one of those things where we should be unleashing the power of our agriculture. Folks like you who want to get back to farming, we should be doing more of that and investing in it. But, you know, in the one big, beautiful bill, there was a fig leaf that was thrown to rural America. There's about $50 billion fund that's going to maybe the Rural Health Transformation Program, as they take Medicaid away, as they take SNAP away, all the social safety net programs go, there's going to be a little something, maybe, scraps you can fight over?
This is what truly baffles me about the big, beautiful bill. Besides the fact that it's just bad business, I mean, if you think about it, if you blow a hole in our government's operating budget and then you give tax cuts to billionaires and then you add trillions to the federal deficit, I mean, that's just bad business. Any business owner will say that's a recipe for disaster. Put that aside, blowing a hole in the government's budget, taking away things that working people need, healthcare and food, and then you put this like fund aside to somehow help rural hospitals or even the farm provisions that were in the One Big Beautiful Bill. I had a conversation with a farmer and he said, well, I don't like the bill, but at the very least, and that bothers me. We should never accept at the very least. We deserve the most. We as farmers and workers, we power the economy. The economy works because of us, and yet the economy doesn't work for us.
No,
and this is another example of them, instead of doing strategic investment and being more efficient about their spending, they're just throwing money at the problem.
Well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I've been reading reports that rural America is getting screwed over on in infrastructure spending that was supposed to come out of the Biden money, out of the big transportation bill. That's not, because for whatever reason. But we're not making the kind of investments in rural waterways and wastewater and energy assistance and transportation, all of those things that we should be. This is something that's nonpartisan, and I don't understand how it's being allowed to not move forward with the kind of investments that we need.
I mean, honestly, I think the reason that all these essential programs are being cut, and I get offended because basically what the government is saying is that, well, we're cutting this in the guise of efficiency. It's just not worth it. Well, when you say that, you're saying that rural America isn't worth it. You're saying that the Arkansas worker, the Arkansas farmer, that we're not worth the time and energy and the investment.
Yeah.
But really what it is they're taking money away so they can give it to their buddies and pad the bank accounts of billionaires.
You know, I wonder, you know, if this were the 1940s and we had this kind of thinking, would there be electricity in my home here in rural Pennsylvania? Would we have plumbing indoors? Would we still be going in the outhouses?
Yeah. And what also baffles me is that, you know, we talk about bringing in investment and business and industry into Arkansas, and we go out and we court these businesses that build data centers. Well, these data centers, they come in and they use our infrastructure. We give millions in infrastructure development money to these corporations that bring in data centers that provide, what, tens of jobs? And yet they overburden our water systems and our electrical grids. I mean, if you want to start talking about industry development, let's go to the small business.
Yeah.
Let's develop the factories and the plants that are already here. Let's stop giving so much money to people who already have enough
and start thinking
about the people that don't have enough.
And I got to ask you, you know, as someone who, a sixth generation farmer who sadly has lost your farm, how much of that is due to toward the monopolization of agribusiness and these big corporations who do get the tax cuts, who do get all of the sweeteners from folks like Tom Cotton, who will take their call and take their checks, where someone like you, who's just fighting to stay afloat, doesn't have that kind of access?
Yeah, consolidation is poison for any industry, really, over mass consolidation for the farms themselves, for the companies that sell us our fertilizer and our herbicides, right now we're talking a lot about farm data, the mass consolidation of farm data, who owns that data, who controls it, how it's used. It really comes down to choice and the ability of farmers and small business owners to control their own future.
Well, let me ask you this, since you brought that up, you've now hit somewhere that is really near and dear to my belief, because we are losing our ability to have any bit of privacy. These data collection centers and Doge Boy and his ferrets who stole all the federal information. How do we, you know, because look, a lot of my rural farmer friends are like, we can't even fix our tractor because it's proprietary. We now got to subscribe. How much of the freedom that my generation grew up believing was there, how much of that is being eroded by these big data collection centers and these big corporate interests who just want to sell us subscriptions to the next who knows what?
You know, I've had a lot of conversations about this, especially as, you know, AI is kind of coming into the mix. And a good example is, so there are a lot of ag tech startups, technology, agricultural products that are brand new on the market. And these companies, they come to farmers and they say, hey, pay us this much and we'll put our brand new product on your farm. We'll collect your data and we'll make our product better for you. That's backwards. Really, I joined a group of farmers and we all collectively got together and said, you know what, brand new ag tech startup, you can come on our farm and use our data and we get equity in your company, because data is an asset. Our data is just as much of an asset as our tractor is, as our warehouse is, as our land is. We have to start thinking about data, the data that someone has that is valuable like a currency, as being an asset.
Yeah.
And being compensated for that asset.
Yeah, they do call it data mining. So they're getting nuggets of gold somewhere.
Right.
Last line of questioning I've got for you. How can we help? I mean, look, I want people who know what it's like to get their hands dirty. I want people who know what it's like to go home and fall into the chair with an aching back and not be able to pay the bills at the end of the month. I want those folks in the halls of power. What can we do? How can we help? What's the ask?
Well, right now we are doing our grassroots fundraising. So one of the things that we want here in Arkansas is we don't want to be written off as a red state anymore. We are no one's political property, and we want the nation to know that. We want the nation to turn its face to Arkansas and see something other than hate. We have to prove to DC that we can do this, that we are a powerful market, that we are a battleground state. And to do that, we have to raise money. So any contribution towards a grassroots movement like ours makes it bigger, makes it grow, makes us more powerful in the eyes of the establishment.
If I can't farm, I'm going to fight, and I'll be there right with you. And I'm sure there are a lot of Americans who want to join that fight as we try and reclaim, well, what's left of the prosperity of our working class. Hallie, I appreciate the time. I hope you'll come back and share some more with us down the road as your campaign continues. I wish you the best, and good on you for jumping in.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time. Hallie Schaffner. Make sure you check out their website, hallieschaffner.com. We'll get links out on social media. Is this what we want, right? We want working class people stepping forward, standing up and going, hey, I'll take them on. I think she's a good one. HallieSchaffner.com. Make sure you check out the website. Quick break. Right back. Stick around.
You're listening to The Eagle, WLCX, La Crosse's home for Matt and Air on Air.
Connecting audiences, powering brands. This is Civic Media. Learn more at civicmedia.us/advertise.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Warm and muggy tonight with showers and thunderstorms around. Some could be strong with damaging wind gusts and heavy rainfall. A low in the low 70s. Mostly cloudy for the weekend, scattered showers and thunderstorms, and still pretty humid. Highs in the low 80s. We're sitting at 84 degrees right now.
Matt and Air on Air.
I have a baby bird stuck in a birdhouse.
Its head is stuck.
Terry on the text line says, if you can detach the birdhouse, bring it to Ace Hardware, they can help get the bird out?
Really? Richard from Waukesha, you get the last word on this.
I like the idea of the Ace Hardware.
Yep.
But some advice is don't let them talk you into a remodeled bathroom.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yes.
Matt and Air on Air. Weekday mornings 9 to 11 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So what we've been talking about over the last several months is, look, organizing around better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, something that we really want to be leaning into, especially as what we're seeing coming out of this administration, not good for working people. And while they're going after gutting regulation, going after, you know, gutting wages, it's going to be us, we the people, who come back together and find ourselves, you know, doing like our grandparents did. Rebuilding this country, rebuilding a prosperous working class, and, well, making American work pay once again, which is why I'm thrilled to have my next guest come share her thoughts and what's going on over at Starbucks. As you know, we've been talking about this for quite some time. As you see, little by little, they're beginning to organize this behemoth into a place where maybe people can actually, make a living. And here to share some thoughts on what's going on there, I've asked Jasmine Lally to come share some thoughts. She's a Starbucks barista there in Buffalo, kind of where all this stuff began. And she's also one of the bargaining delegates with Starbucks Workers United. You can check out their website, sbworkersunited.org. Jasmine, thanks for taking time for us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
So, you know, walk me through what's going on right now, because I see some great stories. I see some great news. I think in Reading, the store there just voted to organize. Walk me through what's going on and maybe why this all started in your view.
So what's happening right now is we have hundreds of partners that are joining the union every single month. We want change at our workplace. We all love our jobs, but we should have a say. And so right now we are working to get the company to come back to the table so that we can finalize our contract.
What's interesting about this to me is, you know, I look at the former CEO was someone who was, you know, potentially could have been Secretary of Labor, and to see Starbucks, who, you know, the image was that they were about community, that they were treating their workers well, all of this stuff. It hasn't, in my view as an outsider, hasn't really jived with how long and how hard it's been for you guys just to get recognition and a contract.
Right. Yeah. So, it really hasn't been easy.
And I assume it's not going to get any easier because, as we've been saying, you are in the middle of negotiating, right? There's bargaining going on?
Bargaining is not happening currently, no.
So you've got how many? Let's start with how many stores are organized at this point?
We're over 600.
Oh, wow. And how many stores does Starbucks have?
I believe 10,000.
Oh, wow. Okay. I'm because, you know, the way I'm looking at this, and I was just reading something the other day that was walking me through the process. What's it going to take to get them to the table, do you think?
That I'm not sure. There's never that, like, okay, this is what's going to get them. It always seems to be a collection of things that happen at the same time.
Okay. And walk me through what conditions, you know, brought this on. I know Buffalo seemed to be the heart of where this began. You know, what made you guys go in that direction?
So I started at my store after they had organized and won their election. And I just was intrigued by the union and I wanted to get involved in the entire process. So they, working under the conditions that we were working under during COVID, not really knowing much about the pandemic and just kind of things changing all of the time, it inspired the workers there to organize their stores because wanted change.
Much like most places when the workers organize, it's about making conditions better. Most of the time, in my experience as an organizer, it wasn't always about wages. It was all about treatment.
Right.
So, you know, when you look at this, have things gotten better since the union has come in and begun to organize? Or do you think things have gotten worse? Or has there been retaliation? What are you experiencing?
I think that things have definitely gotten better since stores have organized. We are able to come together and perform collective actions in our stores to create change. So things have definitely changed in the positive for the unionized baristas and the baristas that are not unionized. Since the organizing drive, we were able to get credit card tipping for all stores in the United States. And we've since also won expanded parental leave. So joining the union has definitely been a positive change for Starbucks.
So what do you say to the person? Go, well, you know, you're just serving coffee. Why do you need a union? You know, what's the argument there?
I think it's so much more than we just serve coffee. We are the people that keep the business running. And so we are interacting with the customers. We're working with the equipment. So we understand what all of that entails. And so when you have someone that isn't working in the store day to day and dealing with the customers, they don't necessarily like understand everything. All of the decisions that are being made don't always necessarily like translate well on the floor. So it's important that we are really the drivers of, you know, letting corporate know, like, this is what we need to make things run better and more efficient at the store.
Because this is a multi-billion-dollar company, right? I mean, you know, this is a big behemoth of a corporation. You said, what, 10,000 stores?
Yeah.
And, you know, from what I've been told and people that I've talked to, you know, wages aren't the greatest. You're not gonna live on this. The conditions have been questionable, and all you're looking for, as I understand it, and you can explain it to me, is that little bit of dignity, that little bit of respect, to be able to put a roof over your head, and, you know, have your head up at work.
For a lot of people that work at Starbucks, everyone's situation is different. You have students, people that want to work full-time, people that want to work part-time. We don't make a livable wage at all, and that's what we're asking for. We're asking for better working conditions, and we're also asking for consistent hours. You're completely at the mercy of your store manager who plans the schedule and, like, the staffing levels at the store.
So, you know, in looking at this, you know, it shouldn't be this difficult. I'm old enough to remember old timers who said, you know, you went in, you signed cards, you had majority, and they recognized you began bargaining. It was that simple. Now it's this long, drawn out process. It's, you know, it's a hostile process. Have you felt that hostility?
Yeah.
In what ways? You know, walk us through what it's, because most people who are watching this, they have no idea what you're going through. They have no idea how hostile a work environment can be when you're saying, hey, I'm not going to put up with the status quo. I'm not going to take what you're giving. I produce a huge amount of profit. We should be sharing into that. Most people don't know what that's like. Can you give us a little insight?
Yeah. So when you work at Starbucks, like I said, you are at the mercy of your store manager to schedule you for the hours that you need to survive. And when you aren't being scheduled those hours, then, you know, you have to make really hard choices whether or not you can afford rent or afford to eat. So it's what we're up against right now is some pretty terrible union busting that can be shown in many different ways. That can be hour cuts, that can be surveillance, which means there's extra management in the store watching things that people are doing. With all of these new policies that have been released by the company, writing on cups is one of those things. None of this has solved any of the core issues that we have at our stores. And so when you're working short-staffed and you're just trying to get through the day and serve the customers in like a timely fashion, you also have to get a good customer connection score, which means like make sure that the customers are satisfied, all by, you know, if you miss writing something on a cup, you can get disciplined and get in trouble for that. So it's just all of these extra rules that we're living under, but we don't have consistent schedules or staffing. Just to put it in perspective, in the morning time, I work at a drive-through cafe store. There can be 7 to 8 of us on the floor, which is people like going to work in the morning. That's usually between like 7 to 10 o'clock in the morning. Right after 10, 10:30, that drops off to maybe 3 or 4 people in these stores. And you still have a ton of customers that are coming in and wanting to get served. And you kind of have a mess from the early peak in the morning. And, you know, you don't have enough staff to get all of the tasks done, but we're still expected to write on cups and, you know, make backups and things like that. It's really stressful.
Yeah, I never got the write on cups thing. What is it? What's that about?
It's supposed to be a sweet, you know, gesture for the customers. But when you're being forced to do it, when you can be disciplined for missing one, that's really hard, especially when we're being timed on how long it takes us to handcraft these drinks and get them to the customer in a certain time period, also while working short-staffed.
No, it's an interesting way that I haven't heard put before, handcrafting this coffee. Because most people, I'm not a huge coffee drinker, but I think, you know, it's just coffee. But when you put it in the, this is, you know, because I do know some people who get into these weird concoctions. This is really skilled kind of work, though, isn't it, on a certain level?
I would say so. Social media has really amplified the different ways that you can have a drink at Starbucks and all of these different toppings and things like that. So when you come through and you place an order and say you saw something online that you want to try, we have to kind of like figure out what is the best way to bring that into our system and to make it. So the machine pulls the shots for us and we of espresso and we do everything else. And it takes about, you know, 1 to 2 or 3 minutes to make the drink, write on it and hand it out.
Yeah, I gotta tell you, I'm not a customer service person. I'm not very personable. You came in, gave me a hard time. I'd probably strangle you other than, you say, well, you want what? Here's, get out of here. I wouldn't last long, which is why, you know, I look at a company like Starbucks who should be grateful that people like you want to work there and put up with people like, well, like me.
Yeah, I mean, and you have to do it all with a smile because that's just our job. That's what we have to do. And it can be very stressful. It's like being in a fishbowl because you're trying to work like as fast as you can. You have to greet every customer
make eye contact, smile, and, you know, try to start a conversation with them, all while you're trying to read, you know, a recipe that's on the cup, and, you know, make sure that you smile.
Hold on, stop. Outside of getting coffee, you got to put on a show too?
Yes.
Oh, now, see, now we're getting crazy. yeah, absolutely. Now, you know, because I couldn't work there. They'd fire me on day one. So let me ask you, because, you know, this is, I'm making light of it a little bit, but, you know, do customers appreciate this? And if they do, you know, what kind of response are you getting as you're saying, look, I would like some dignity in this position. I'd like a living wage. You're paying a fortune for this cup of coffee. I should share a little bit in that. You might not want me to come from the homeless shelter here to serve you coffee. What kind of response are you getting from folks?
For the most part, the customers are sometimes, they're, you know, understanding. I don't think that they always understand what we're going through. You know, usually when you go into a Starbucks and you see a long line, that's usually red flag number one, because that means that either there's some large event going on, or, you know, maybe there's not enough people that are working at that time.
Or you just have really bad management who didn't staff properly and didn't get the people there that when you needed them. Because, you know, this is the weird thing, and I've seen this happen in other places where customers will be yelling at the person who's making their food, which just seems weird to me. But like they're the last person to be able to decide how many people are working there. So why you take it out on them? Maybe, Karen, maybe ask for the manager at that point instead of every other moment. Just kind of a thought.
Maybe.
And maybe if you had a union and you had a contract that said, hey, maybe we're gonna negotiate staffing levels, that could be beneficial for the consumer as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. It would be a win-win for us and a win-win for the customers. We'd be able to do our jobs and get them out at a reasonable time.
So last question I've got for you. How can we help? How can customers help? How can I help? How can people help? Because look, ultimately, I want people to make a good wage. I want them to have job security and not be fired for not writing on a cup. I hope most people want workers to have respect. So how can we help?
So as customers, what you can do is, if you know your store that you frequent is not a unionized store, maybe talk to them about organizing their store. You can call corporate and tell them to finalize the contract with the Starbucks baristas. Be patient. If you go in and you see the baristas are overwhelmed, we're just doing the best that we can. And if you see us on strike, don't ever cross the picket line, please.
No, you never, ever cross a picket line, ever. So I got to tell you, there's one in Reading, not too far from me. I'm not a coffee drinker, but I will go. Maybe a Danish, something. Who do we call and yell at right now? Is there a corporate person? Is there a direction? Is there a campaign of who we yell at?
You can call Starbucks corporate, and I wouldn't necessarily yell at the person on the phone, but just, you know, because they're just doing their job too. But just, you know, have a message to pass along to the CEO of Starbucks and just say, you know, finalize a contract, treat your workers better.
There you go. Jasmine, I appreciate you taking some time for us.
Thank you.
Keep
so
up
much.
The fight. Keep up the great work. I wish you the best. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again once victory is achieved. Thanks so much. Jasmine Lally, barista there at the Buffalo Starbucks. Next time I'm in Buffalo, I'm going to have to swing by there. Want to hear your thoughts. Are you a Starbucks customer? Would you be willing to help? I want to hear your thoughts. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. This day in labor history, the year was 1850. That was the day that two tailors who were out on strike in New York City were killed in a confrontation with the police. It is thought that they were the first workers to die while participating in a strike in the United States. They certainly would not be the last. The United States has one of the bloodiest labor histories of any industrial nation. It's estimated that at least 700 people have lost their lives to violence during a strike. The vast majority of those slain were workers. Some of the most bloody conflicts included the Great Upheaval of 1877, where across the country, 100 workers lost their lives in an uprising of railway labor. Then, in 1892, the strike against Carnegie Steel in Homestead, Pennsylvania, 9 strikers and 3 Pinkerton agents died. 2 years later, 30 workers died across the country in a boycott and strike against the Pullman Palace Car Company. One of the most infamous labor massacres occurred in Ludlow, Colorado in 1914. During this coal mining strike, gun thugs hired by the company rained machine gun bullets and fire down on a tent colony of striking workers. At least 19 people were killed. 11 of them were children. In 1937, 10 workers died on Memorial Day at a demonstration against Republic Steel in Chicago. These are just some of the battles, massacres, and murders that shaped the American labor movement. Too often, the toil of this bloodshed is not taught in history classes. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
I apologize to Jasmine. I forgot to bring up their no contract, no coffee pledge that folks can take a look at and sign up for, and I will most certainly be signing up for it. You can do that at sbworkersunited.org. Look, at the end of the day, we should be demanding that workers have the right to organize for better wages, hours, conditions. And look, you know, we know that workers organize to join unions for the fundamental reason of collective action. It gives workers power that they could not have going into the boss's office alone. This idea that, well, you know, I can make my own deal. Yeah, that never seems to work out. And understand, when workers do come together, they get the ability to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, better schedules, more with safe workplaces. They're coming from a position of strength rather than, you know, whatever dear leader wants. And understand, in the corporate setting, boss is king. If you're in an at-will situation, you're just that, at will. When that will is no longer there, they can fire you for any reason or no reason whatsoever. So what unions do and do very well is negotiate on behalf of all members. They get contracts that have clear standards for pay, job security, health care, retirement. You go down the list, fair treatment. You go down the list, it's spelled out. That contract is very clear. It's in black and white, very simple. Even the boss can read it. And understand, for the individual, it leads to real, measurable improvements, not just in work, but also in work-life balance and home life. Because we know that union members earn consistently 10 to 15% higher wages than non-union workers do. And look, we know that union people who have a union card in their wallet also generally have a health insurance card. They've got retirement plans, paid medical leave, paid leave, protection against, well, being fired because the boss felt like it. And we know that it narrows the racial, the gender, the economic inequality gap massively. Our grandparents' generation, they fought for a prosperous working class. They fought for better opportunities for themselves and their children. And understand, employers hate unions, which is why you see so much anti-union stuff out there in the ethos. Because understand, if workers are earning higher wages, if workers are getting health care and retirement and paid sick time, that means less for yachts. That means less for the employer class to divvy up among themselves, along with their shareholder buddies. And understand also that unions don't just benefit members. And we've talked about this for years.
if there's a strong union presence in any industry, wages are up for everyone, the union worker and the non-union worker. You know, when we had 35% union density in this country in the private sector, that meant you had 35% of workers making good, solid union wages, but also about 35% of the non-union sector making just about the same. That spillover effect, that gives us a more robust and more equitable labor market. And understand, high union density is linked to all kinds of things. Higher productivity, lower turnover rates, more workplace training, greater civic participation. Because if you're empowered in the workplace, generally that's going to spill over into the community affairs. Again, something the employer class, the wealth class, something they don't really want. They don't want people who think that their voice matters. So when you look at these workers who are, you know, just working in a coffee shop going, hey, we demand better, we should all be behind it. Societally, we should be demanding that corporations recognize workers' rights to organize when they want this. Because, well, it may not affect you directly in your paycheck, but it's going to have a spillover effect into the greater economy, into defending democracy. Because understand, when workers have a real voice, you have some corporate checks. There's some balance there. If the CEO gives himself a $100 million raise, don't you think the union's going to come to the table and go, hey, buddy, how about throwing a couple of nickels this way? And understand, when that happens, economic growth becomes more broadly shared. And we get that thing that they talk about all the time. Something like a middle class. And when you have workers who have higher wages, especially those union workers, they pay more in taxes, less rely on public assistance, strengthen the public coffers, increase social stability. Lots of things that we should be demanding and wanting, not just for ourselves, but for the community as a whole. Basically, in short, unions aren't just tools for you to do better or me to do better. They're the pillar on what this country was built on. A fair, productive, inclusive society where people who work hard, play by the rules, actually do get ahead. And understand, encouraging unions means investing in the dignity of work, something I talk about all the time. Also helps with, you know, making sure the local community is healthy because people have health insurance. They can go see a doctor when they're sick. These are things when you talk to individuals, people want. Democrat, Republican, independent, right, left, center, up, down, backwards. This is what working people want, and it's what we should be demanding. It's what we should be demanding from our political leaders. It's what we should be demanding every time we go to the polls. But just as important, and what my grandparents' generation understood, your dollars matter. So take the pledge over at sbworkersunited.org. Don't go to a non-unionized store until they have a contract. Never cross a picket line. But when you see an organizing campaign happen, and I've said this for years, grab a box of coffee from one of the places that maybe is unionized. You know, grab a pizza or something, go to the picket line and talk to those workers. Be part of the work that they're doing. Because ultimately, the life that they're making better could be yours, could be mine, could be ours. And if we fight for a just society, if we fight for equality, if we fight for a working class that can prosper, I think, you know, cause we've seen this before. I think it's better. And I want to hear your thoughts. Have you come across a Starbucks campaign? Are you going to take the pledge? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. Miss any portion of the show, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours, freespeech.org, the website for the video. And as always, thanks so much for being here. See you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show.
email Rick. Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Soaring high above La Crosse, this is Eagle 1490 AM WLCX La Crosse, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Chuck Sievertson. The Emory University campus gunman fired shots toward at least four buildings of the nearby Federal Centers for Disease Control, says the head of the CDC. Atlanta police say the shooter is dead, so is an officer wounded by the gunfire. Cops say the shooter fired from a campus drugstore. This is some of the gunfire posted on social media. Police say the gunman was found shot dead on the drugstore's second floor. The man accused of killing four people at a bar in Anaconda, Montana, a week ago, has been arrested, say police. The big wildfire in the mountains near the border of Los Angeles and Ventura counties is 25% contained, says the Ventura County Fire Department. ABC's Monica DeAndes at the scene.
The fire officials are asking people to be ready to go at a moment's notice. There's still evacuation warnings in place. There's evacuation orders in place.
President Trump says he and Russian President Putin will meet a week from today in Alaska. This is ABC News. The meat plant at the heart